KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum, we talk with animal scientist Temple Grandin about animal behavior, humane animal welfare practices, and autism, which she believes has given her a different way to understand and decode animal thinking and behavior. She joins us in conversation next after this. I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum. Temple Grandin was and designing livestock facilities. She's the author of two books on autism, including Thinking in Pictures, and has published hundreds of scientific papers. Her newest book, written with Katherine Johnson, which Oliver Sacks calls deeply moving and fascinating, is Animals in Translation, Using the Mysteries of Autism to Decode Animal Behavior. She's presently associate professor at Colorado State University, and she joins us for this Forum Hour. Welcome.
It's really good to be here.
Good to have you here. Let's talk about your story a little bit as background here, because you start with your story in the book. And I wanted to ask you, because I read about you as a child feeling a lot of ridicule, people thinking you were talking like a tape recorder, all of these kinds of things, and then the diagnosis of autism. Autism is still a fairly difficult diagnosis.
Well, the thing about autism diagnosis is it's basically a behavioral profile. It's not precise. Like if you went and did diagnosis of tuberculosis, you do a lab test and you go, yes, the person has tuberculosis. Things like autism and Asperger's syndrome, or even things like manic depression, if a person's behaviors fit a certain profile, then it's diagnosed. It's not precise, but if that profile is applied correctly, there's a high correlation with that profile and with things like brain scans. Autism is a neurological disorder. It's caused by abnormal development in the brain. It ranges from very severe, the person who's going to remain nonverbal, all the way up to brilliant scientists. Einstein had some autistic traits, and he had no language until age 3.
Well, you didn't talk till you were about 3 and a half, too, right?
That's right. And I had the full-blown symptoms of autism. I had no speech, no social relatedness. I'd sit in the corner and hum and rock. I had the full symptoms. Somebody that has Asperger's syndrome, the child's going to have more or less normal development when they're little, but they're the odd kid, the kind of loner kid, the science nerd kind of kid. There's a continuum from normal to abnormal, and there's a point where Asperger's just merges in with a kind of nerdy, and it becomes a personality variant.
But you say in the book that you are living proof that autism can be modified and controlled.
Well, the child is born with different degrees of abnormality in the brain. And a child that's got seizures and lots of abnormalities isn't going to get to where I'm at. But if he gets really good education and intervention, he's going to be able to shop. He's going to be able to have basic living skills. Otherwise, he wouldn't have those things at all. Somebody like me, if I didn't get the right education, I certainly wouldn't become a college professor. I can't emphasize enough the importance of early education and intervention. It's so important. The worst thing you could do with a 2 or 3 year old autistic child is let them sit in the corner and watch TV all day. They need to get lots and lots of hours of interaction with an adult. And I got that as a child. My mother hired a nanny who spent hours just playing turn-taking games with me and not letting me retreat back into spinning this little brass thingamajiggy around on the bed.
Well, we're going to talk about how autism ties in with decoding animal behavior, but you say at one point in the book, actually a couple points in the book, that you have no unconscious, and I don't know how one can determine, because the unconscious is something we're not aware of. How do you know you have no unconscious?
Well, they talk about the stuff in the Freudian subconscious, and I finally figured out that the subconscious for most people is what I think with. And when I think in pictures, I'm using the basic, visual-based memory files, or you can use auditory-based memory files. There's a whole layer of subconscious thinking in most people buried underneath language. And there's actually some brain research now that's showing that this is true. There was some paper published in Neurology by a doctor named Bruce Miller, and he found that in a certain type of Alzheimer's disease that destroys the language part of the brain, autistic savant-like talents in art and music will emerge, because now you're getting direct access right into the visual and music parts of the brain. And some people think you have to have language in order to be fully conscious. And I go, well, that's just absolute rubbish. I mean, how could I become a college professor if I wasn't conscious? That would just be impossible.
Well, there are a few unconscious college professors. I'm trying to be enlightened.
Okay.
Some levity here. But as a college professor myself.
Okay.
But there's a sense that you write here of thinking in pictures, and what you say, in effect, is this is what animals do. Animals are like autistic savants.
Well, animals have to think in sensory-based images, sounds, sights, or smells. I'm not going to think in language. And I often get asked, well, how can you be so good at talking? Well, the thing is, language narrates the pictures that are in my mind. When somebody asks me something about an animal behavior problem, I then bring up the pictures in my mind and they tell me what their horse or their dog is doing, and then I start visualizing that horse or dog, and I think he might be doing thus and such, and I use the language to explain what is going on with the pictures.
In fact, the reason you say you have no unconscious is one of the examples you use in the book. You say you go into a movie and you'll see violence and blood and gore, and the pictures stay with you. It's not as if they go into another part of your brain. They stay in your conscious mind.
Well, people that are not language-based have a very hard time suppressing those images. In fact, there's been some research with post-traumatic stress syndrome where the people that continue to have post-traumatic stress syndrome got the memories of the bad experiences back as pictures. So I do not want to go to bloody movies that show graphic depictions of cruelty and violence. Now, kind of cartoon violence, like Kung Fu, that doesn't affect me, but I don't want to see, graphic cruelty.
So there's a kind of potential, at least as you see it, and this is one of the fascinating things about your book, and by the way, the book is called Animals in Translation, that animals, there's a genius to animals. I think that's the word you use.
Well, yes. Animals will often become geniuses in one specific thing, like birds are geniuses in migration. The bird just has to be shown the migration route just once, and then he remembers all the sensory stimuli along the way. Squirrels can hide their nuts in hundreds and hundreds of different places. And I just had a chance to talk to the lady last night that did that research, and she said that after the squirrel hides a nut, he jumps back, and then he acts like he's taking a picture. Well, that's what I do when I have to park my car in a parking lot that's not marked. I mean, I work with a lot of the big meatpacking plants, and they have these great big, football field-sized parking lots, no numbers or no signs. And how do I remember where my car is? Well, after I get out of the car, I look at the plant buildings and like to take a picture of how the angle of the edge of the building looks. And that's how I find my car. And I just found out last night in talking to the scientist that it's exactly what the squirrels are doing for finding their nuts.
Well, you're right about a woman named Jane whose cat knows exactly when she's going to come home, even though the time changes in many instances, and we find out that it's done by the cue of the elevator. But in reading that, I must tell you, I thought about how is it that these cats, for example, sometimes find their way home, or dogs find their way home, through many states and through a lot of geography. The mystery, again, of that kind of genius, that's something we don't really even understand.
Well, I think what's happening is they're doing it the same way a homing pigeon finds their way home. There was work that was done on homing pigeons, and they found that birds remember sights along the way. Okay, now let's say you put them in a carrier where they can't see anything when you take them away, then they remember smells along the way. And if you put them in a smell-proof, light-proof box, so they can't get any smells or any sight, then they're not able to figure their way home. So they're remembering sensory details. Animals and people with autism are in the details. In fact, there's a man right here.
What separates us from the animals,
right? That's right. Animals think with details, and they put the pictures together, put different details together to form a concept. Like, for example, in Animals in Translation, I talk about a horse that's afraid of black cats. Well, he was abused by a person, and he was looking right at a black cat when he was abused. And so now he has a picture in his brain that black cats are bad. White cowboy hats are fine. Black cowboy hats are bad.
Just like the cowboy movies, or at least the way the cowboy movies
used
to be. I was also thinking about this idea of animal genius and how animals know things that we don't know and sense things that we don't sense. In the cat story, it brought to my mind the fact that I had a cat that had been upstairs in my house for months and months, living upstairs, essentially. And the cat was very ill and had to feed it intravenously and so forth. The night before the cat died, the cat came downstairs, barely able to move, and had not been downstairs because it had been upstairs living and because it was very difficult in this invalid capacity to come downstairs. It was almost as if the cat knew, really, on some level, it was going to die.
It probably did. It was because it had probably had sensations of how it was feeling, and You know, maybe it wanted to be with you.
Want to say goodbye.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, that's right.
That was my sense. And this, as opposed to people, and in fact, you use the word abstractification. That's a good word, but talk about that.
Well, I work with a lot of different people, and to make things work out in the field. In fact, I've worked with the meat industry on developing an auditing system that McDonald's and Wendy's uses and Burger King uses for auditing meat packing plants for animal welfare. It's based on very simple measurements. You score 100 cattle going through. Well, how many were vocalizing and mooing? How many slipped and fell down? And you just count these things. And it's worked very, very well. And to do things out in the field that work, you've got to touch with the field. You've got to actually go out in the field. And I find what happens in a lot of situations is you get managers in high places where their thinking becomes totally abstract. I think this is one of the problems we have with government today. I mean, politics is more and more partisan. I don't care which side of the issue you are on, and I don't care what the issue is. People that get the most partisan tend to be the most abstract. They are people that live in offices, and it all becomes verbal abstraction, and they totally don't even know what's going on out in the field. I don't care what the issue is. I think we're getting into more and more problems with that. We need to have people in high places that get involved with issues need to get out in the field. I just had a student wanted to have me be on her master's committee, and she was a philosophy major, and she wanted to defend being a vegetarian. I said, okay, all I'm going to ask you to do is I want you to take a nutrition class. I want you to visit some farms. I want you to learn more about this than just the abstract. Okay, you're still entitled to maybe have an opinion different than my opinion, but I want you to have more down-to-earth, you know, non-abstract knowledge about the subject.
Talking to Temple Grandin, and her new book is Animals and... Animals. Later. You kind of take up the whole question of... When people often ask you why you work in the slaughterhouse business or in the meatpacking business when, for example, cows are the animals you love the most, although you have a beautiful shirt on with horses, we might add, that you're wearing today. And your answer to that, your response to that is, it's a telling response in many ways.
Well, first of all, the cattle wouldn't be here if we hadn't bred them. And we owe those animals a decent life. I feel very strongly about that. In fact, one of my biggest concerns in animal welfare right now is what we're doing to animals genetically. Lameness problems in dairy cows, not right now, it's just horrible. Everybody just got into breeding them for milk, feeding them too many concentrates. And this is an example of bad becoming normal. When I started with dairies back in the 70s, you only had 5% lame. Now it's gotten up to 20 and 25% of the cattle lame. Breeding dogs for just single traits. I mean, really stupid things like white Dobermans. You know, breeding all these blue-eyed huskies that are going to end up having neurological problems.
This is all the selective breeding
yeah.
for desirable traits.
Yeah.
Or to
but
have
you,
them in or out.
If you go overboard on any single trait, I don't care what it is, you're going to end up wrecking your animals. I mean, there's been a bad problem with roosters, with the broiler chickens. You know, they want to breed chickens with big breasts, and then they had problems with heart attacks. So then they bred chickens now that have strong legs and they're stronger. Now they had a weird problem where in the breeder colony, the roosters were just raping and chopping the hens up because the little courtship dance that the rooster normally does to ask the hen to mate somehow got deleted. You know, these traits are linked in odd ways. Now the breeding companies are starting to correct this. They're going to the breeding colony and they're culling out the roosters that do this. But traits can be linked in unexpected ways. So you overselect for one single thing and you can end up with some bad surprise happening.
These roosters, which you write about in the book, that were raping, had a lot to do with environment, too, in addition.
Not really. It had to do with genetics.
Strictly?
Yeah, it was genetics. These chickens are not in cages. Broiler chickens are not in cages. That's egg birds. These chickens are on sawdust running around just in a great big barn. Now, another problem you have with egg layers, they were breeding just for eggs, and the hens would lose all their feathers, and it was automatically blamed on the cages. No, it was genetics. Because you go to the same type of cages and you've got brown chickens in there that are a calmer genetics. They also take 10% more feed to get the same amount of eggs. They still have their feathers. Yes, there are some problems with cages. There have been problems with cramming them in way too tight. But But when I started to investigate the chicken problem as part of my work with McDonald's, I was finding that genetics was a really huge issue here. And now they're backing off on some of this flighty genetics. So when they select it just for egg production, they ended up with a nervous wreck of a bird that's cannibalistic, pecks the other birds, and beats their feathers off. Now, if you want to get away from having to cut off the ends of the beaks, what we need to do is select birds that don't peck. And a scientist named Dr. Muir done research on that 20 years ago that shows that you can select chickens that are not cannibalistic, but they're going to take a little bit more feed to get the same amount of eggs.
You also mentioned that you're concerned about what breeders are doing to purebred dogs.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of bad things going on with dogs, and there's a lot of bad things going on with horses. You know, you have halter classes, where it's basically just a horse beauty contest, you know, so they breed certain horses just for the halter class. I went out to a big fancy stable one time, and there was a colt out there with a leg deformity, and they were going to surgically correct that so they could show it in the halter class. Well, they ought to go ahead and geld him, too, because they should not be perpetuating genetic defects.
Coming back for a moment to animal behavior, what you said about animals seeing details and seeing pictures and everything, there's this experiment that certainly I'd read about, but read about in detail in your book, where we'll talk about it. It's a gorilla suit experiment. Fascinating in terms of what
basically, I mean, you can put somebody in a gorilla suit in the middle of a basketball game or in the middle of some other thing. People won't notice it. Sometimes just won't notice it if they're not expecting it. There was another experiment where NASA put pilots in the simulator and then parked an airplane on the runway, and some of the pilots landed on it because they were not expecting it. The normal brain, you know, due to being language-based, tends to screen out a lot of detail. And what I found in my work with the slaughter plants, as cattle were not afraid of getting slaughtered, they were afraid of the details. Things like the chute is too dark, or there's a shiny reflection on water. And then if you move a light, that reflection goes away. A little chain hanging down, maybe seeing a person through an open side of a fence, and then you cover that up with a piece of metal, and you get rid of these details that they're afraid of, then they'll just go ahead and walk in.
Similar to autistics?
Yes. Autistics are also into detail. I can remember as a young child, we had a rainstorm, and the roof leaked a little bit, and it made a little brown spot on the ceiling of my bedroom. And I started visualizing furniture spilling in from upstairs, crashing down through the ceiling. Well, now I know enough about building construction to know that that's just impossible. With just a little leak, might make some plaster fall down.
But as a kid, you were terrible anxiety ridden.
Yeah, little things like that, you know, like a rip in the couch or just some little thing. Animals tend to notice the things that seem out of place, because out in nature, some little sudden movement may mean danger, some little novel thing. You know, animals are really tuned in to be oriented towards anything that's new. And the thing about things that are new things are both scary and attractive. Something like a yellow raincoat or an umbrella, if you let a horse or a dog just walk up to it on its own, it's attractive. You shove it in its face, it can be really scary. And I think it's really important to get animals desensitized to new things. And if you're showing horses, I often hear people say, oh, well, he was fine at home and he went berserk at the horse show. Well, you have three real scary things there: bikes, flags, and balloons. And we need to get the horses gradually introduced to those things long before they go to a show. Now, the worst thing you could do is just shove it in the animal's face. The best thing you could do is decorate his pasture with flags and let him just walk up to them on his own. And the thing that's interesting, the animal is the high-strung, flighty, nervous animal. Be the first one to approach a flag, but also the first one to panic if you took that flag and just shoved it in his face.
So the assumption here is that despite not having language, animals have consciousness.
Absolutely, they have consciousness.
And feelings, of course.
Absolutely. And let's look at how the nervous system is set up for feelings. In all mammals, circuits that handle pain and fear are very similar. Mammals and birds have the same neurotransmitters. And if you give a dog Prozac or you give a dog Valium, it has the same effect on a dog that it has on a person. So you've got those same basic circuits there. There's been some research that shows very clearly that animals feel pain. And the very best experiment for determining that animals feel pain, and it's not just a reflex, is will it self-medicate? In other words, there was work done with rats and with chickens where they artificially caused arthritis by injecting some chemical into the knee joint. It wasn't a very nice experiment. It only had to be done once, but it proves that animals will self-medicate. And so they get the legs sore, and then they give them two waterers or two feeders, and one of those waterers has got painkiller. The other waterer has just got plain water. Now, the painkiller water tastes terrible. And when the leg's really sore, he drinks lots and lots and lots of the painkiller water. And then as it heals, he switches over to more and more of the plain water. And that works in the rat and in birds, and that proves to me that, yes, they definitely do feel pain.
Speaking of water, and you also spoke of Prozac, I have a cousin who, for some reason which I cannot divine, gave his cat Prozac, and the cat had not been using a litter box, had Prozac and started using the litter box, and then went off the Prozac and went back to not using the litter box. I don't know how one explains that.
Well, Prozac is a very strong anti-anxiety agent. Small doses of Prozac or one of the other SSRIs like Zoloft or Paxil or Celexa or whatever can greatly reduce anxiety. I've been on antidepressant medication for 25 years, and I went on it in my early 30s. I was one of the kind of people that, whereas I got older, I got more and more anxious. And this can also happen with, just with anxiety disorder. And so I started taking a little bit of antidepressants. And, you know, there's been a lot of bad publicity lately about antidepressants and black box warnings about suicide and stuff like that. That's caused by overdosing. You give them too much Prozac, person can't sleep, they're going to feel like 100 cups of coffee. That's just giving too much. You've just got to give a little small dose. In fact, in my earlier book, Thinking in Pictures, I described that in detail. It's still accurate, even though it's 10 years old at this point.
So the SSRIs would have the same effect on animals, pretty much, as far as reducing anxiety?
Yeah. They would reduce anxiety. And maybe the cat had some bad experience in the litter box, and now that the anxiety was reduced, he's now, willing to go back there. But small doses of SSRIs, they work very well for relieving anxiety.
So aside from details and visual pictures, big difference in neocortex between us and animals.
Well, basically, you look at brains, and I've had the opportunity, I took an anatomy class, and I did anatomy class on human brain. I've also done pig brains and other animal brains. And you look at the lower brain circuits involved with emotion, the pig brain and the human brain are just about the same. What's different is a gigantic, huge cortex. We simply have greater computer power that they don't have.
We get into this whole controversy of whether our minds or our brains are like computers, but we're not going to go there.
No, okay.
I want to talk to you more about animals. We're coming up on a break here. And have you known Jeff Mason's book, the psychoanalyst who wrote about animal
feelings?
Yes,
I do.
When Elephants Weep, I think it's called. I mean, you would agree with that basic premise.
Well, I think animals definitely have feelings, but we need to make sure that we don't get anthropomorphic about it. I think animal feelings are simpler. They can be happy. They can be sad. And the long-lived animals, such as elephants, do have a sense of what death is.
Temple Grandin says, don't anthropomorphize, empathize, right?
You need to empathize, but you need to be like how the animal would actually think.
Again, Temple Grandin's new book is Animals in Translation, Using the Mysteries of Autism to Decode Animal Behavior. It's written with Katherine Johnson. She is a famous animal scientist who has worked in, for many years, in animal slaughter and the whole world of livestock handling. We'll continue our discussion with her after a brief break, and remind you, you're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Pratt. Michael Krasny. We're talking this hour with Temple Grandin. Her new book is Animals in Translation, Using the Mysteries of Autism to Decode Animal Behavior. She earned her PhD in animal science from the University of Illinois and went on to become associate professor at Colorado State and has written a number of books on autism as well as published hundreds of scientific articles and was herself diagnosed as autistic when she was a young girl. When you write about your story, in fact, one of the lots of fascinating things, but you went to see Skinner. You went to see the great man, B.F. Skinner. And what a story. I mean, he went to putting his... He went to pawing you is really what he went to doing.
Well, I went to, of course, in the 60s when I was in college. I mean, B.F. Skinner was king. Everything was operant conditioning.
Behaviorism
was totally behaviorism. They didn't talk about the brain. Like I said to B.F. Skinner, well, we need to learn about the brain. And he said, we don't need to learn about the brain. We just have operant conditioning. Well, I could never believe that because I was taking a really good ethology course from a professor named Tom Evans. And he was an expert in reptiles and animals. These are animals that have a lot of instinctual, hardwired behaviors. And what I learned from Tom Evans just totally conflicted with B.F. Skinner. and I never could buy it, that it was totally behavior. And then I was really happy when the Breelands paper came along. And the Breelands, I've trained animals for little carnival shows, like you had a chicken in a little house and you put 25 cents in and she played a piano. And they were trained with operant conditioning. And they found there were certain situations where they could not go against the animal's natural hardwired instinctual behavior. And they wanted to have a raccoon take a quarter after it was put in the little house and put in the piggy bank. And in the beginning, the raccoon would do that. But then after a while, the instinct would take over, and he'd have to wash the coin. So he'd be there trying to wash the coin, and he wouldn't put it in the piggy bank. And the Breelands came out and said, we were totally trained as behaviorists, but we were totally, you know, flabbergasted at the extent of some of our failures. There were certain things that's difficult to train an animal to do. You can train a pigeon to peck a switch, but to train him to paw a switch is extremely difficult.
You know, what one learns from your book, among many other things, is how important animal welfare is just in terms of doing good business, good profitable business.
Well, absolutely. And in meat, if you handle animals quietly, you're going to have better quality meat. Now, there's some situations where business and welfare collide. Unfortunately, you can make a building make more money if you cram the chickens in so tight that they're on top of each other, because even though the productivity of each individual egg-laying hen is reduced, the overall profit of the house goes up. When it comes to welfare, beef cattle, when they're done really right, is one of the best animals when it comes to welfare. And in my work at McDonald's, when I got taken into the egg layer house, I was pretty appalled at some of the stuff that was going on in there. Jamming chickens in so tight that when they were laid down at night, they were all on top of each other. Well, now there's a trend in the egg producers to stop doing this. There were some egg producers that were taking live hens when they were old and throwing them in the garbage can alive because they'd been bred to be such egg layers, there wasn't enough meat left on them to make them worth processing. I was just totally appalled. Now, the broiler chicken, like your Tyson broiler chicken, that's not in a cage. I just want to get things clarified here. Those are raised in big sheds where they just walk around on sawdust on the ground. And then in pigs, you have the issue of sow stalls, and that's something that's going to need to be phased out, you know, making a sow live in a box for her whole life.
What's your take on organic beef and raising for organic purposes?
Well, one of the things you have to realize with organic beef is organic doesn't automatically mean good welfare. And I've done talks with organic groups, and I've emphasized we've got to make sure we're doing slaughter audits in the small plants, because you wouldn't want to be a situation where a big corporate plant was better than a small plant. The big corporate plants, really, for the most part, getting in good animal welfare standards. And there's been some awful problems. There was an awful problem that just happened recently in a beef plant. But it was in a plant that was outside of the audit system. It's not on one of these restaurant supplier lists and getting audited. And one of the things we need to make sure in organic that you don't let happen is you don't want to have an animal get sick when it really needs an antibiotic because it's sick and it doesn't get it, because you want to keep the organic status. People that want to do organic really need, we need to really do things right. I mean, there are organic ways to treat the animal, but you're going to have to really manage things right, you know, to keep them healthy, because you don't want to have a situation where you say, well, we only grass feed our cattle, but then they get really skinny in the wintertime. The good organic people are doing animal welfare. I've been doing some consulting with Whole Foods to make sure that, you know, those animals are treated right. There are there's certified humane, which is like a natural organic type of product, and we make sure that's raised humanely. Just make sure that your organic beef or organic chicken or whatever it is, that they're also watching out for the animal's welfare, and that you're not getting a situation where medical treatment is withheld from an animal that really needed it because they don't want to lose the organic status.
You need to be mindful of animal welfare also in the sense that if you're not, we've learned, I think, some harsh lessons in Europe about mad cow getting through. I mean, actually escaping the vigilance of even some of those who are supposedly looking for that sort of thing.
Well, the whole mad cow thing was caused by feeding ruminant protein in large doses to calves.
Right, but I'm just saying spotting those cows, for example, who are going through who have mad cow, there's a real problem just, again, with the scrutiny that is necessary.
Well, right now, in Europe, they've banned, ruminant protein to all living things.
Right.
Some of the restaurants and things do a really strict audit in the meatpacking plants to make sure the spinal cord is removed, because that's the main material that can have the transfer mad cow, and that their suppliers are not feeding any ruminant protein. I think eventually, all these rendered proteins, we're going to have to figure out how to make these into fuels. We've got to just break the cycle.
Hear, hear.
Because if you make it into fuel, then the prions are destroyed.
We're talking, if you just joined us, with Temple Grandin. Her newest book is Animals in Translation. You still have your squeeze machine?
Yes, I still have it, and I still use it, and I got the idea for a cattle squeeze chute that's used to hold cattle for vaccinations. Deep pressure is very calming to a lot of, autistic children and adults. You know, pressure calms down the nervous system. And one of the things I found is sometimes you put the cattle in the squeeze chute for their vaccinations, they just kind of would stand there. And I was terribly nervous as a teenager, so I went out and I tried out the squeeze chute, and I found that the pressure was calming.
You could call this your main squeeze, in fact.
That's right.
Some of the new animal research that you get into here, for example, there's new research that wolves probably change the structure of our brain.
Well, thing is wolves are really good hunters. Wolves are also very social. One of the things about the dog-like, the dog animals, is they can be dominated strictly socially. And it only takes about 20 generations to domesticate a fox and turn a fox basically into a border collie dog. And this is some research done by Bellion. He just selects the tame foxes. They actually get black and white like a border collie, and they get more gentle, and they get more serotonin in their brain, and that's the stuff that Prozac gets more in your brain. And, ancient people that had wolves that they had raised and hunted with those wolves. Imagine the advantage you'd have. Now you could hunt big animals. Also, the caveman probably watched how the wolves hunted, so they got ideas on how to cooperate in hunting. And also, wolves would protect you. I mean, it'd be tremendous advantages to having wolves.
It makes sense in terms of evolution. There's no ambivalence in animals and no ambivalence in autistic people?
Well, thinking tends to be simpler. Now I've had to learn that things are shades of gray, that a lot of issues, it's not clear right or wrong. You get out there in the field and you really get involved, you realize there are, something, you might say, well, this thing's always wrong in all situations. And then there might be some situations where it might not be wrong. And I kind of look at it like mixing paint. All I can say are people that get politically involved in an issue, and I don't care what the issue is, you've got to avoid the abstractification. You need to go out and find out what's really happening on the ground. And that can sometimes, change what's going on with an issue. Like looking at the animal welfare concerns about housing. Yes, there are problems with housing. Jamming too many chickens in the cages is terrible. Sow stalls, that's going to need to get phased out. But then when I started to get involved with it, and I really got out there in the field, I saw all these genetic problems. Now, if you're just up there in abstractification land, you don't even realize that genetic problems exist. I only realized that because in all the meatpacking plants I work in, I see lots and lots of different animals. And for example, when the lean line pigs come in, I go, well, why are these pigs so nervous and crazy? And then pigs from another farm that were the fatter variety of genetics, they weren't so nervous. And I started, seeing these things. But let's say you're breeding hens, and they gradually get more and more nervous, and they beat off more and more feathers. You don't even realize that change is happening, because you don't see any other animals to compare it to. I call that bad becoming normal. It's very easy in a lot of things to lapse into bad becoming normal, and you don't even realize it.
It's also easy, I would imagine, to abstract animals simply because to many of the people in the business of finding profit through animals, animals are a product. Animals are a commodity.
Well, and those people that are, you get people in high places just looking at computers and numbers and things like that. And it was very interesting working with the restaurant companies when the welfare stuff first became an issue. The attitude from some of the executives was, why do we have to do this? This is like stupid. The attitude from a lot of people was that way. But then I went on some of these initial tours where we took the people out into the meat plants and farms. And when things were going well at the slaughter plant, they go, oh, it's not as bad as I thought it was. But I remember the day when one of the executives saw a skinny, emaciated, half-dead dairy cow headed right for their product. And he was just shocked. And you got into some situations like this, and eyes got opened up. And they're going, oh, wow, there really are things where you can make a difference. because now we've gotten the executives out of the office. I call it dragging the suits out of the office. And we've gotten them down in seeing things in the field. It was really good, because then it started to take on a life of its own, and they started to get really interested. Now, it didn't affect all of them that way, but it definitely did affect some of the executives that way. It was really a good thing, because it was no longer abstract to them anymore.
Well, we've come a long way from Upton Sinclair's The Jungle and all that sort of thing, but there's still some pretty appalling practices out there, are there not? I mean, people like you have helped enormously, but the fact is they're still extant.
Well, there's still some very bad things going on, and right now, as far as slaughter plants, they are happening mainly in the plants that are not part of one of these restaurant or supermarket auditing systems. Of course, McDonald's and Burger King and Wendy's, they do not buy lamb and veal. And they're now, some of the food service companies are starting to go out and audit lamb and veal, and they've walked into some bad problems, like live lambs on the going down the line. That's like totally, totally disgustingly bad. And they had to take a plant off their approved supplier list. And you see, because those plants are just now starting to get their audits. And there was a situation in the beef plant about a month ago, absolutely appalling, disgusting situation in the beef plant where they were pulling the windpipes out of live cattle. And again, this was a plant that was not on any of these auditing systems and getting audited by a restaurant company or a supermarket.
Sorry, Temple Grandin, her book is Animals in Translation. It's difficult to measure intelligence in autistic children or children with Asperger's for that matter. And it's difficult to measure intelligence in animals. I was thinking in reading your book when I was a kid, I used to read the World Book Encyclopedia, and remember, under animals, there was a list of intelligence, and right at the top, they had chimpanzees, number one. You know, it was like the top ten, and followed by orangutan, followed by gorilla, monkey, and dog, cat, raccoon, elephant. Anyway, and horse was that way down there, in fact. What do we use in terms of criteria to measure or to provide standards for how we measure intelligence in animals, particularly since they think like autistic children?
Well, first of all, the animals that are the most intelligent tend to be the long-lived animals. Parrots, elephants, dolphins, animals, chimpanzees, they live a long time. So they have a lot of chance to learn. Now, the thing is, animals tend to be specialists. They'll be really intelligent in one thing and really, you know, dumb in another thing. Like they say, well, a dog's not self-aware because when he sees a dog in a mirror, he acts like it's another dog. But I'm sure a dog is smell self-aware. I'm sure that dog knows, you know, when he marked that fire hydrant, and he knows his mark from some other dog's, mark on the fire hydrant. They're smart in their own way, and there's one of the things in intelligence. True thinking is being able to solve a problem under new conditions. This is the way Marion Stamp Dawkins, defines true thinking in animals. She likes to define it by what it's not. It's not simple operant conditioning, where, okay, the light comes on, you press a button, you get the food. That's simple operant conditioning, simple association. It's figuring something out in the new condition. And there was a very good experiment that was published in Science with crows. I think it was Science. I tend to get Science and Nature mixed up. Where crows figured out how to bend a piece of paperclip wire and stick it down into a little tube and snag up a tree. And the way that crow learned to do this, first of all, they gave her paperclips that were already bent, and she could snag her food out of this little tube by sticking the hook down into the little tube and pull up a little bucket. And then after she learned how to do that, they took away her hooks, and they just gave her straight wires. And she sticks them in there, sticks them in there, sticks them in there, and she can't get it out. And then one day she sticks the end of the wire in a crack in the bench and bends it and makes a hook. Okay, now that is true thinking. And then the male came along and stole all our food.
What about measuring, for example, that kind of thinking, let's say in dog breeds? You write about, I've owned Labradors and I've owned mutts, and I was interested in the distinctions you make between Labradors and mutts. I had a mutt that did a lot of chewing as opposed to Labradors, which have not done chewing, but Labradors, as you say, are constant eaters. In the Army, for example, they put, I don't know if you're familiar with these kind of tests, they put different breeds through, and they just determined somehow that poodles were the most intelligent animals, most intelligent breed of dog, among that particular animal. And it was done through all kinds of sorts of things like problem solving, like you're suggesting.
Well, it depends what you want an animal to do. I mean, different dog breeds, on the average, have different traits. But there's also a lot of variation within a breed of animals, too.
Sure.
Labradors really like affection and petting. and border collies tend to be less interested in that. But within a breed, you can have border collies that are really affectionate. You know, but traits like sociality and fearfulness, which you'd measure by the tendency to startle, or aggressiveness, there's genetic basis to some of these different
there's
traits.
There's a lot of gene pool stuff, yeah.
Yes, there is. And it's a complex interaction between genetics and the environment. You could have an animal that has a very fearful temperament, and if he's raised gently, like an Arab horse, for example, he'll be a beautiful horse, a really smart, intelligent horse. If you abuse him, he's just going to be ruined and be a nervous wreck.
Or a pit bull is a good example, isn't it?
But one of the problems I think we've got with pit bulls is here, this is one of the few breeds where the dogs have actually been, in some cases, bred for aggression. So what's happened is a normal dog will growl to warn you. Some of the pit bulls no longer warn you. If you breed dogs specifically for aggression, you're going to end up, you know, really getting into trouble.
There's this long-standing argument about, you know, are cats smarter than dogs or dogs smarter than cats? It's a different kind of intelligence. It's hard to quantify. Cats generally tend to be a lot more independent, so people will say because they're independent, they're more intelligent. Dogs tend to be more obedient and do what you tell them. Therefore, people will say, well, that makes them more intelligent. And other people say, no, the cats are more intelligent because they're independent.
Well, dogs are more social. I mean, one of the reasons why the wolf was the first animal that got, you know, domesticated into the dog is it is social. This is an animal that you can control and dominate strictly socially. Cats are going to have to train with food. If you want them to do tricks, you do clicker training where they associate a click with food and you teach them to do all kinds of things. But a dog will do stuff where you just strictly for praise and for petting because he's highly social. In fact, the domestic dogs have been bred to be even more social than the wolf. And there's been an experiment done where they found that a wolf was not able to tell where a person was looking, you know, where his food bowl was. In other words, a domestic dog, it will pick up on the cue of a person looking at the food bowl. You know, they'll pick up where the eye gaze is going, and the wolf won't do that. Even a hand-raised wolf will not do that. So we've actually bred dogs to be these, like, you know, hyper-social animals. It wants to please you. It's easy to train an animal that wants to please you.
I think it's sad in many ways that wolves have been identified with aggression and with attacking humans and so forth when they really are quite social, as you
well,
say.
The thing is, what a predator eats, it learns. I mean, dogs and wolves have a tendency to want to chase things. But what you eat, it learns. Like in killer whales, for example, some killer whales are fish eaters. Other killer whales eat seals. It depends what they have learned. In fact, animals like the big cats have to learn that, you know, the antelope they catch is actually food. You know, the prey drive to run and chase, that is instinctual. But what you eat, the animal has to be taught. And this brings up another important thing. We got a lot of behavior problems with dogs and other animals because they're not socialized. An animal that's reared by itself, that never socializes with other adult animals, will often become a vicious fighter. This happens in dogs, it happens in horses. Young puppies and young adolescent animals, colts and dogs, need to interact with other adult animals to learn the give and take of social relationships. And this will prevent a lot of problems with fights between animals, and animals need to be socialized to many different people. You need to teach your puppy and teach adolescent dogs that not just your own toddler you're nice to, you better be nice to every single toddler. You need to take the puppies into the daycare center so they learn that all toddlers you be really nice and gentle with.
Talking to the author of Animals in Translation, Temple Grandin, book written with Katherine Johnson. I'm going to give you a name. I'm going to make it up. You're a bovinophiliac. You love cows, right?
Okay, yep, I certainly do.
Why? I mean, it's your favorite animal, in fact.
Well, it's the animal that I first started working with, and I find that, you know, most people that work with animals, their favorite animal tends to be the animal they've worked the most with, and it's the animal I started working with, and you really get to like the animals that you work with a lot.
They're gentle animals.
And they're very gentle. And one thing I like to do is to sit down in the pasture and let the cows just come up and lick me, and, you know, I lay on the ground in a feedlot and let the cattle come up and lick me all over.
But see, there's an example of an animal that's not considered very bright, though. I mean, a cow, you know, in fact, most people associate them with just, you talk about the word bovine even is associated with indolence and lack of intelligence.
Well, the thing is, they're herding animals, and herding animals, you know, follow the herd, which can make them seem stupid. But cows have to learn, and sheep have to learn when they're young, like what you eat, where you eat. Sisters that are raised together in cattle will graze together when they grow up, and the adult cows will stay together, so they sort of form little families. They're not as stupid as they look. One of the things is, an animal that's motivated to please, like a dog, it's easy to get it to do things. One of the things in trying to do things with cows is they're just not as motivated. Another problem you can have with some of the grazing animals, if you teach a cow to go through a maze, it learns really well on the first time through the maze. But then, like the autistic person, they get really rigid. Once they've learned that a certain path through the maze is right, it's difficult for the cow to switch that path and then learn to go down a new path.
Speaking about animal intelligence again, there were some experiments which I'm sure you're familiar with a number of years ago where they showed that, or they hypothesized that the more convolutions on the brain, the greater the intelligence. And it turns out that dolphins have more convolutions on the brain than humans do.
That's right, and they also don't have REM sleep, and how that affects how the brain works is still not fully known.
They also have, curiously enough, sexual aberrations that are like human sexual aberrations.
Well, a lot of animals do get that, especially if they stay cooped up too much. Another thing I think we need to be looking at in animals is how they use tone. I think tone of voice. There's, tone of voice was the only subtle cue as an autistic person I'd pick up. Like, I could never understand why people wanted to meet face-to-face when you had phones. Now, I absolutely despise email, but I really like the phone because I can listen to how the person sounds on the phone, and I can tell whether...
You get a picture in your mind?
I can just get a picture of whether this person's happy or this person's angry. And I also start to get a little emotional feeling from that. And I think animals have some very complex things they do with tone. And I think, a lot of people wonder, what's music for? Well, I think music is basically how animals communicate. And in the book, Animals in Translation, I review some experiments done on prairie dogs. And I can never pronounce the scientist's name correctly, like Slobodan something or other. I can't pronounce
it. Not Milosevic, huh?
No. And he's found that prairie dogs have calls that are like nouns, verbs, and adjectives for different predators. These are animals that live for maybe, 50 years in the same colony. They can pass knowledge on, and they have a word for fox, and whether he's moving fast or whether he's moving slow, or whether he's the one that sits next to the hole, or he's the kind that just runs up and grabs them when they come out.
And they have language.
He's a very good scientist, so he doesn't want to come out and say they have language. But they certainly are using these calls in a way that's more complex than the famous vertebrate monkey experiment, where they have a call for a ground predator and an aerial predator.
You served as an advisor on Rain Man.
What I did for Rain Man was explain to Dustin Hoffman what being autistic felt like. Problems with sound sensitivity, problems with loud sounds hurt my ears. They had a scene in Rain Man when a smoke alarm went off. Well, certain loud sounds like that were like a dentist drill going down my ear. I explained to him the problems with nervousness. And I said, well, Dustin, just imagine when you had your first really big, important interview. Just imagine what you felt like. Well, that's the way I used to feel all the time. And so I helped Dustin Hoffman learn about how the person with autism felt. Now, since he was doing a savant-type autistic, there were other people like Joe Sullivan that he used to show what the person looks like. I told him what it felt like.
What would you tell, because we've done shows on autism and on Asperger's syndrome, and you've written on the subject and you've lived it. What's the best advice you can give to parents who struggle with this?
First of all, small children. You've got to get really good early education. You've got to do it. Now, if you're in a low-income situation, get the grandmothers in the neighborhood to come in and just work with the kid. But my other big concern, especially now that we have this Asperger's, the real high-functioning smart ones, is I get worried about some of these kids getting stuck in special ed rut when they ought to be, building computers or something like this. And one of the things that can really help these kids is having mentors. And I had a great science teacher in high school. Skills are going to be uneven. We need to work on developing the talent area into a career. And there's three kinds of brains in Asperger's. There's the visual thinking, like me. There's the music and math brains. And then there are the ones, I call them the verbal logic brains. These are people that have become language specialists. They don't have any visual thinking. They're not good at music, but they could be excellent journalists. They might be really good at pharmacy because they could learn all the different medications. They'd also be excellent language translators. And if they became experts in Middle Eastern languages, they got job security for life.
So it's very important at an early age to get good diagnostic sense of what brain is operating and at what level.
Well, on some of these things, that what I find, you know, we look at the people that are successful, and there are a lot of Asperger people that I work with in the construction industry and the meat industry. One of the reasons they were successful is because they had somebody in a welding shop sort of just take them into the business, and now they're designing equipment. They sort of just slid in the back door. Mentors are attracted to talent. One thing I say to people, since you're awkward socially, you need to make a portfolio of your work so you can sell your work. I heard a very sad story about a lady that was very good at doing drafting and designing, and then she ended up getting in a fight with the employer and lost her job. She didn't have any of her work to show. You got to keep some of your work. So if you can say, well, here's a, you know, some engine parts, you know, that I designed, you know, so you have something to show. Because you have to sell your work rather than, you know, being really social.
Well, you've got a lot of that to show. I mean, you've accomplished a great deal. And, again, it's the book is Animals in Translation, Temple Grandin's new book. It's been a pleasure to have you here. Thank you so much.
It's been really great to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
The book, again, is subtitled Using the Mysteries of Autism to Decode Animal Behavior. And she's the author of Thinking in Pictures as well. This was written, as I said, with Catherine Johnson. I want to remind you that we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and an hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. Our producers are Robin Giannatasio Mal, Hermione G., and Kevin Guillory. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. We welcome your comments and feedback. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or let us know what you think by calling our listener call-in line, 415-553-3300. For all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Kresge.